This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh. I'm Tony Bruschi. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage. We now go to segment number 5 in the courtroom.
Mr. Griffin?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Mr. Crosby.
Good afternoon, Mr. Griffin.
Can we get this photo taken down? We just kill it? Just kill it? Yeah, the Oma. That was the computer thing. There it went. It's good. We're good. Thank you.
Mr. Crosby, I was struck by a comment you made, and just want to confirm it. You were informed by folks at the meeting when Alex was confronted about financial misdeeds. According to the reports you received, that Alex's response was he knew he was going to get caught at some point in time. Was that what was reported to you?
That's what I recall. Okay.
And he asked you to speak at, eulogize Paul at Paul's funeral, right?
He did, and I did.
Yeah, and you were very close to Paul, and Paul was a super guy, wasn't he?
Yes to both of those questions.
Yeah. You said that Paul carried around a 300 blackout and a 12 gauge shotgun, a Benelli Super Eagle, I believe you said?
That's my memory. Obviously they had numerous guns, but I had seen Paul with those on multiple occasions.
If I showed you a Nelly's Super Eagle that's in the courtroom, would you be able to recognize it's Paul's or not? Or?
I don't know at this juncture. I believe it was camouflaged.
Camouflaged Super Eagle. Okay.
All camouflaged Super Eagles.
Right. I'm trying to not point at anybody, but does this look like Paul's gun?
I'll say it looked like it. Will I say it was? I can't say that.
Understand. And Your Honor, I'm holding up, for the record, State's Exhibit number 4. And I put my papers down. Also, you testified that when you got to Moselle the night of the 7th, that you were you went through the main entrance, and that's the entrance with the, I guess, the brick facade or whatever, the brick gates opening up. That's the main entrance you went in?
Yes, there's a brick facade and then I think the metal iron gates. Okay. But they were open.
And then you go up, and you would have gone straight to the house if you'd gone straight, but you turned right, and you said, and there's a little roadway there, an old runway, and you were able to get back up to where the kennels were from that direction, correct?
That's correct. It's not far when you turn right, a couple hundred yards maybe.
And then, but you said you were able to see shell casings, what you thought would be 223, where were they?
The the one, I don't think I saw everyone that was there. I remember seeing one, seems like in the driveway. Closer to the road from Paul and Maggie's bodies.
So were you able to get inside the crime scene tape?
I don't know if there was crime scene tape up at that point in time.
Okay. So you were able, as you recall, just to walk up. Well, were Maggie and Paul's bodies covered at the time you got there?
Yes.
But you were able to get into the crime scene close enough where you could tell what you thought the caliber of the shell case.
Right, and I didn't walk from where I was parked there. I walked completely around the hangar and went over to talk to people I knew that were there, the fire and rescue people, just to get what their assessment was. And I could see from where they were positioned, I could see, I wasn't like, I didn't get over it, but I could see from a distance, and I'm very familiar with
sure.
firearms, and I saw what I thought was a .223 casing.
And you later learned, I guess, the next day on the 8th, that it wasn't a .223, but a .300 blackout. Is that right?
Yes, and I can't for the life of me tell you there was that point in time. There was some law enforcement out in the hangar and around, and I just asked a question, and they corrected me.
Right. Okay. And that. And you started to assist any way you could with trying to find out who could have done this. Isn't that right?
Well, Jim, I didn't that night. I was trying to get, and we were starting to. I don't know. It was shot, man. You know. But in the days following, we had a lot of conversation amongst my partners and I about who could have done this. And obviously, we were theorizing on stuff, and you know, with very little information, obviously. But we were trying to find out things, whether Paul had been in an argument with anyone, or you know, if anybody had. I don't know, it's just what you would naturally do, is ask questions.
One of the things, you went down to Jimmy Butler's, you remember that?
I did.
Now, what's Jimmy Butler's?
Jimmy Butler's a business in Varnville that does mechanic work. He sells trailers, he sells portable buildings, used to sell cars, but I had learned that Paul had taken his truck there the Friday before the murders.
Right. And so the Friday before the murders, Paul's truck, and what was his normal truck? Was it F?
It was an F-150.
A white F-150.
White F-150.
And you had understood that his white F-150 was put in the shop at Jimmy Buck?
Yes, and I specifically was going to see if Paul's guns were in his truck.
Right. And did you check the truck?
I did. I looked inside of it, and I also got. I had learned that a Mr. Rowe was working for Alec at the time, and had taken him over to pick him up when he took his truck to drop off for repairs. And I asked Mr. Butler to pull surveillance tape so I could see if Paul got his guns out of his truck while he was getting out of one vehicle into another.
And because you, it was Paul's habit to carry the guns in his truck, right?
Right, and I believe actually when I looked in there was still a pistol and some shotgun shells, that type of stuff in there, but I didn't see any long guns. I didn't get inside of his truck and rummage around. I just looked.
And so you didn't observe any 300 blackout or any shotgun in Paul's truck at Jimmy Butler's, is that right?
I did not.
And then I think you also looked at videotape to see if Paul took guns out of his truck when he got back in. I guess Mr. Rowe picked him up, is that right?
That's correct, and another one of another pickup that Ella had on the farm.
And you didn't see Paul removing any guns from his truck when he got in the truck with Mr. Rowe?
That was not evident on the video.
Okay.
And I could see him getting out of one vehicle into the other.
And you were... you were down there on the morning of the 8th, and after Sled had released the crime scene. When I say there, I'm talking about down at the kennels. Were you not?
Yes, I was asked to go there by Randy's brother, Alec.
Okay. And I don't want to be too grotesque at all, but just were there still blood and biological material there at the scene?
Yes.
Okay. And did you notice that there were some still birdshot pellets in the feed room that had not been collected by the sled agent?
Yes. They were what appeared to me to be we could pretty much tell what they were, yeah, from looking up. And I believe they would have been a TSS type load.
Okay. And did you gather those up, to your knowledge?
Did I?
You or anybody, you know, with you?
Jim, I mean, Mr. Griffin, I apologize. We know each other, so I...
Please, call me Jim.
That area in that room, well, we could see them. It was so bad. We thought we were going to, at some point, clean it up, but it overwhelmed both my partner, Mark, and I. Well, we could see that, and we could see everything, all the other aftermath. We were getting biological material. Just couldn't be there. It was bad, you know, and it was overwhelming us. So, no, I did not try to collect evidence.
And the scene inside that feed room, I take it as something that still is etched in your mind's eye memory.
Yes.
When you were down there when you got there the first time, I believe you went up to Mark Ball, and he was there. He got there before you.
Maybe a few minutes. Okay. We had already talked about, you know,
did it look to you and Mark like the crime scene was being preserved and carefully keeping people off of areas that maybe they shouldn't be trampling on?
Well, it was my understanding that the crime scene had been released, so okay.
Well, I'm talking about 11 o'clock. I'm sorry, I jumped back. 11 o'clock when you got there, around 11 on the night of the 7th. When you pulled up, as I understand, you walked around the shed, the workshop, and went to the back, and maybe Mr. Ball was back there. I could have that wrong, but is that what happened?
Well, we were there. I saw people working through the crime scene, and you're kind of asking me for an opinion that I don't feel qualified to give, because I assumed that whatever was going on was being done with procedure, you know, whatever procedures. But there were people in that, you know, in the crime scene doing various things.
Okay. And I'm not asking you to give an opinion. I was just asking you if anyone expressed an opinion in your presence about they shouldn't be doing this or should be doing that.
I don't specifically recall.
Okay. Well, did at some point in time, you and Mark and whoever else, were y'all directed to go to the main residence at?
We were, and for the life of me, I can't tell you who told us to go. I can tell you it was at the time that whoever is the photographer for the crime scene, they were getting ready to start, you know, taking photographs, and it was stated that we're going to photograph the scene. Y'all go to the house. We don't, you know, you don't need to be in these photographs.
Okay. And so who all went to the house, best you can remember?
I know I did. I know Mark did. Austin Crosby, who's one of my partners, did. Danny Henderson did. Randy Murdoch did. John Marvin did. Ellick at some point did. And he may have been, I believe he was accompanied by some officers when he came. I think maybe Chris Wilson may have. The others I'm positive of, but sure. There could have been a couple other people.
And had it looked to you like anybody from law enforcement had searched the resident, inspected the residence before you guys went in?
I don't know that I would know what it would look like if it was had been searched. It was my perception that it had not been searched yet.
And then you mentioned at some point in time Alec came up and maybe law enforcement were with him?
Mr. Griffin, my memory is that Alec came in, and at or about the same time, two agents came, and I remember them collecting his clothes is what stands out to me. One stood in the doorway or the foyer to the house. We were kind of in the living room and maybe the kitchen area. And then another agent, and I'm assuming it was Sled, but it's kind of blurry, and it happened pretty quickly, went maybe to the door of a bedroom while Elliot was changing clothes, and then he brought his clothes out and gave them to the agent who stood in the edge of the living room or foyer, whatever you want to call it.
And did the agent just open up a bag and Elliot dumped his clothes in the bag? Is that how you remember it? A paper bag?
I do not know what the composition of the bag was. It was a bag, and it seemed to me the agent was holding the bag out, like, open.
Right.
And that Alec kind of had his clothes in his fingers and just dropped them in is what my memory was. And what that was, I only recall there being one bag, and he dropped them in, and it was like a pretty quick transaction.
His clothes were not put on a hanger, for sure. Is that right?
No, Alec had them in his hands when he came out of the bedroom. He was in there long enough to take those off, and I think he put back on another pair of shorts or something and shirt.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm jumping around a little bit.
It's okay. I've been right where you are,
right.
And that happens.
I think you mentioned in one of your interviews with Sled that Alec had some annoying quirks, and one of them, he would just take phone calls in the middle of the deposition.
He would.
Would he get phone calls from his family, Buster, Maggie, and Paul, and drop everything and take the calls?
I've witnessed that.
Was that frequent?
Yes, he would do it in depositions. He would do it in the middle of a conversation, and not with them, but definitely with them. And even in partner meetings and stuff, he would take a call and walk out of the room.
Sure, sure. You had mentioned in your testimony that when you were asked by Ms. Seckinger about this Ferris fee issue, that really your concern was not that Alec was diverting fees, but he was trying to shelter fees from being disclosed in the civil case. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, let's make sure definitionally we're talking about the same thing. My concern was not that he was stealing, because I trusted him. I had no reason to believe that he was stealing. It was the latter, that what she conveyed to me was he was wanting to hide some fees or hide money somehow. I don't remember it being said that it was like I heard earlier in Maggie's name. It was just that he was going to take the fees from Chris Wilson's account so there wouldn't be any record, is the way I understood it, in our trust account.
Right. And you said, F no, we're not doing that.
Those were my words.
Right. What was Alec's after the murders of Maggie and Paul, did you the immediate aftermath and going forward a few months, did Alec come to the office much?
It was sporadic, but you know, I knew that he was having a lot of trouble sleeping, and you know, he just lost his family and his father, and him and his father were very close. We were aware that or had understanding that he was taking like medicine to try to help him sleep and maybe for anxiety and just, you know, the normal things that you would expect there. So even when he came, I would walk in his office and he'd be falling asleep in his chair. He'd be sitting in there, you know, which was evident to me that he wasn't sleeping well. And so I know Ms. Seckinger mentioned pills earlier that he was taking. That's what we knew he was taking, because he couldn't sleep at night. He'd be up at all hours of the night.
And did you notice changes in his physical appearance? losing weight?
Yes, he was losing weight. I don't think he was eating very well by reports.
And I guess let's sort of go back. The night of June 7th, the morning of June 8th, what was his demeanor?
Well, his demeanor is that he was upset. I could tell that, and
You see him cry?
Yeah, we cried together. I mean, he kept telling me, especially to me, he kept telling me how much Paul loved me, and every time he would say that, we would it would be emotional. I mean, and then he told me that.
Right.
Several times over the next few days. It was just almost be how he would start a conversation when with me would be to talk about Paul.
Right. And then did he spend a lot of time with Buster down at Maggie's parents in Somerville, to your knowledge?
I knew they would be. Can you give me the time frame?
So starting in June?
Okay, so yeah, I mean, I know he and Maggie's parents had a good relationship. And I recall, because in some of this, I remember seeing some texts between he and I that he was down there. And I don't remember, they're dated, I'm sure you have them.
Right.
And he told me he was down with Maggie's parents. It was one of the days in that time immediately following the murders.
Right. And then at one point in time around, I don't know if it's 4th of July, did he come to your place by boat? Or do you remember that? And
I can't say that it was on the 4th of July, but I remember his brother Randy and his wife, I had invited them to my house, for the 4th, for spend, and they had, something that those of us in the law firm do a lot, that spend time on the weekends together, and they were there, and I'd ask Alec to come over, and he and Buster came by boat from Edisto.
Right. And Alec was carrying a gun with him on the boat, was he not?
Yes, he had a gun and what I want to call a shopping bag,
right.
Like a cloth type, shopping bag, not one of those plastic ones.
Had you ever seen Alec carrying a gun around before for protection, before the murders?
No.
Some point in time, Alec and Buster and the family put out a reward, did they not, for capture of tips for whoever would lead to the arrest of whoever killed Maggie and Paul. Do you remember that?
I do remember that and who all was involved in the funding of it, I don't know, but there was a reward, I believe was a, I know a reward was put out.
And the firm agreed to administer it if there was anyone step forward?
We did.
1 second, Your Honor.
Redirect.
Firm have to ever pay anybody for that reward?
No.
You're asked a lot of questions about your interactions and relationship with Alec Murdoch. You've known Alec Murdoch how long?
Well, I guess a total of 25 years or so.
Did you really know Alec Murdoch?
Judge, Your Honor. Eric Reynolds.
What's the question?
Did he really know Alec Murdoch?
Purely a character question.
Did he know Alec Murdoch? Did he really know Alec Murdoch?
Yes, sir.
I sustain the objection.
Thank you. Nothing further.
Anything further?
No, Your Honor.
You step down. If you'll go to the jury room for a break. What's coming up next, Mr. Waters?
Your Honor, we have the GSR expert, and that's the next thing. I think we can get that witness done before the end of the day.
Really?
Your Honor, I just asked Mr. Griffin, he's the cross on this, and
he should
been
take
talking
long.
Nothing but GSR for 2 days, and we're worried about that timetable.
All right. Well, we'll take about 7 minutes.
That wraps up the fifth segment of continuing coverage in the trial of Alec Murdaugh. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our discussions on this case, insight, and courtroom coverage. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.